You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, October 15th, 2012, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Oh, good evening, my friends. How are all of you?
Good.
Super.
What's up?
Quite well.
So the day that this podcast goes out, October 20th, marks a very important date in science history. So in 1970, a scientist received the Nobel Peace Prize. Can any of you guess who it was?
Scientist received the Nobel Peace Prize.
It was Linus Pauling, right?
Nope.
He got the Peace Prize.
Any other guesses?
I have no idea.
1970.
Isaac Newton.
They don't award them posthumously, so no? Okay,
yeah, right?
Time is up.
Aww.
On October 20th, 1970, the Nobel Peace Prize went to Norman Borlaug for his contribution to the Green Revolution, which increased grain production throughout the Third World. He is responsible for possibly saving millions of lives.
Oh, how awesome is that? What a legacy.
Borlaug?
Cool.
Yeah, yeah. Just for coming up with ways to grow crops that was more efficient, that produced more yields, particularly in Pakistan and India, during times when they had severe shortages of food, and even drops from the U.S. weren't enough to protect people from starvation. So,
right.
Yeah, his research went into saving many, many people. So, yeah, he has the Nobel Peace Prize. He has the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the Congressional Gold Medal, the Padma Vibhushan, India's second highest civilian honor, and he's in the United States National Wrestling Hall of Fame.
Wrestling?
What? Didn't see that coming.
Yeah.
Wrestling with tough ideas.
What has he got?
Concepts.
What does he do?
He was a wrestler. I don't know.
Oh,
he was
my God.
Really into it.
What a renaissance man.
Yeah. In high school, apparently he played several sports, but he was particularly into wrestling, and he was on the team at University of Minnesota. He was in the Big Ten semifinals. Mm. He introduced the sport to Minnesota high schools by putting on exhibition matches around the state. So, Wrestling Hall of Fame in Stillwater, Oklahoma.
That's awesome.
And the Peace
Norman
Prize
Borlaug.
Winner. Cool.
And he lived to 95. It's a good run.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
Well, we have one Nobel Science Prize left over from last week that we didn't talk about, the Nobel Prize for 2012 in chemistry. This one goes to two scientists, Robert Lefkowitz and Bryant Kobilka, for their discovery and description of G-protein coupled receptors. You guys familiar with that?
It's a rap artist.
Nope.
So, I mean, they're huge. G-protein coupled receptors. Present
they're really small.
On many cells, and they are responsible for cell signaling, essentially like how cells can sense their environment and react to things like hormones. It's estimated that half of the drugs that are on the market have their effect through G-protein coupled receptors.
That's a lot.
Wow.
That's a lot. Definitely a breakthrough in our understanding of cell physiology and biochemistry. So it's hard. It's one of those things where it's fundamental. It's not really the kind of thing that penetrates to public consciousness because it's kind of technical and wonky, G protein coupled receptors.
Obscure.
But,
yep.
But they're really fundamental to cell function and just was a tremendous breakthrough that gave us had a lot of applications, Now you take it for granted. I mean, we hear about it. I hear about them all the time.
Oh.
It's just, you just take it for granted. This is, how different drugs work, et cetera, how different signals work.
But they figured it out.
So when was this breakthrough?
Definitely worthwhile. So Lefkowitz started the research in 1968, using radioactivity to trace cells' receptors. And then Kobilka joined the team later and discovered the genes. I think the first G protein coupled receptor gene. Now there's something like over 1,000 different genes. It's a huge family of genes. They control, these receptors are involved with perception of light, flavor, odor, a response to adrenaline, histamine, dopamine, serotonin.
Flavor.
Yeah, obviously very, fundamental to neurological functioning as well.
You think they stumbled on this accidentally, Steve, or do you think they were looking to do this?
No. He was looking for it. Yeah. No, this is very specific program of research that paid off very, very well.
So what took so long to give him the prize?
You know, I don't know. This is pretty par for the course for the Nobel Prize. They definitely like to wait a while to see how, what the implications of research is. I mean, I think they have the luxury of giving it 20 years or so to really see how scientific discovery pays off.
Whether or not it's debunked.
Yeah.
Or it's like, whoops, this discovery causes mutations and all sorts of people. We shouldn't be tooling with this stuff.
Some monsterism. Yeah. Right.
Blah.
But there's one discovery, Rebecca, that probably will not be earning a Nobel Prize. The discovery of the half-life of DNA.
Yeah, unfortunately, this discovery will only be earning the power generated by Michael Crichton's spinning corpse. So yes, paleogeneticists at University of Copenhagen and Murdoch University in Perth, Australia, looked into the DNA of leg bones belonging to three species of giant moas, which are those extinct birds that could disembowel you as soon as look at you. Really awesome, impressive birds. And I think
huge.
Yeah, they reached about 12 feet in height, apparently, and they could weigh up to about 500 pounds.
So, wow, that's awesome.
Big boys.
Yeah, impressive birds. But the interesting thing about them is that they covered a decent swath of time that allowed researchers to collect 158 leg bones and examine the DNA to determine the half-life of DNA. And all of these bones had been found in identical conditions. So they were all at a temperature of 13.1 degrees Celsius, for instance. They were all within 5 kilometers of one another. Everything was the same pretty much except for how long ago they actually died. So what the researchers found was that that DNA has a half-life of about 521 years. And that's more or less what it is. It's difficult to say for sure because even though they looked at a lot of different bones, they did only look at bones in a certain part of the world. So they don't really know for sure what bones would be like, say, covered in permafrost or something like that. But yeah, they do have a pretty high degree of confidence that even in a bone at the ideal preservation temperature of negative 5 degrees Celsius, the DNA in it would be destroyed completely at a maximum of 6.8 million years. And so what journalists and other people have immediately jumped to realizing is that Jurassic Park could never happen, pretty much.
Well, except the creationists. They think it could.
Right. Creationist Jurassic Park could still happen, but it would be super crappy because the dinosaurs would all be vegetarians, blah, blah, blah. There's definitely no chance that any DNA would be left after 65 million years, you know, considering that right now they're estimating that it wouldn't make it 6.8 million years.
Even if we use lots of frog DNA to help out.
Yeah, I think you would just end up with frogs by the time you replace
99.99% frogs.
Exactly. Yeah. So it is, sad news.
That sucks.
Yeah. And there are other factors that can make it even worse, apparently, like how the bones are stored after they've been excavated, the chemistry of the soil. And they say that even the time of year when the animal died, might factor into how long it takes for their DNA to break down.
How come only now we're discovering out what the half-life of DNA is? We weren't able to.
I think it was that Moa find was key. Right, Rebecca? I mean, it was just the perfect find in terms of how consistent they were, how many there were, and the time frame. I think that was the big find, took so long.
I would imagine that it's difficult to find a huge amount of bones that you can have such a spread of time, 600 years to 8,000 years, but still with the same soil conditions, you know, within the same distance. So yeah, I guess it's a pretty important find. And, you know, it would be nice to find something else like that in a different part of the world, but I don't know what the chances of that are.
One thing I wonder when I was reading this is, I know they said, like, even under ideal preservation temperature of minus 5 degrees Celsius, every single bond would be broken in 6.8 million years. But does that include every possible condition, you know, specifically in amber where there's no oxygen, no air?
The article does talk about in amber and how that doesn't protect it, because apparently a huge problem is reaction with water, but I don't know if amber perfectly protects it from that, because there's still water in the body that would damage it, you'd think. So I don't know. Oh, actually, there is a quote. Simon Ho, a computational evolutionary biologist at University of Sydney, said, "This confirms the widely held suspicion that claims of DNA from dinosaurs and ancient insects trapped in amber are incorrect."
Too bad.
I wonder why it would, though, since water seems to be so predictive, you know, of the degradation rate.
Yeah, but there's water in the body, so maybe that would be enough, don't you think? Particularly
well, what's the water
content
of amber, too?
And, like, if they, yeah.
So we have to mummify it, then encase it in amber.
Yeah.
You're right.
So all you need to do is go back in time, mummify a dinosaur.
Yeah.
Come on back.
Encase him in amber, and then put him at minus 5 degrees Celsius.
Yeah.
Then we'll have some.
Are we never going to be able to resurrect a dinosaur?
Not looking good, Jay.
It's hard to say never. What if we can take, say, a bird
and de-evolve
it?
Yeah, reverse all of the mutations that occurred. Well, we got the dino chicken, right? I mean, that's...
Yep.
Remember that?
Wait, what was that? I don't remember that.
The dino chicken.
Don't just say it again, like that's going to help, right? Oh, the dino chicken, right.
Tyrannosaurus cluck.
The DC. Yes, the dinosaur.
Okay.
Tyrannosaurus
cluck. Tyrannosaurus cluck, I remember.
Research teams are doing that. They are, you know, doing mutations to reverse some of the changes that led from dinosaurs to birds. So you end up with birds with reptilian dinosaur features.
Well,
that's pretty cool.
That's something. It's not exactly recreating a dinosaur, though.
No.
I mean, you could make a theme park that could then go horribly wrong and result in terror. So
you could.
I mean,
yeah, but after the slaughter,
that's
could
a stupid
it
idea, Rebecca. It'll
good.
Never sell.
All right. Well, it doesn't really matter because the whole universe is a computer simulation anyway, right?
Oh, nice segue.
Someone tapped the side of it. It's glitching again.
Find the old program and run it.
Well, Steve, this is actually freakishly interesting. I was totally absorbed and blown away by learning about this. And I actually even contacted our friend Brian Weck.
Oh, cool.
Who lives in London now, and he was helping me figure this stuff out. I got to ask him a bunch of questions about it. So let me start by talking about a few things to give the background here. The universe at its most basic fundamental level is explained by quantum chromodynamics, or QCD. This is a theory that describes the strong nuclear force and how it binds quarks and gluons into protons and neutrons and how these form a nucleus. So that force actually is interacting on these particles in a very, very strong way, and it overcomes the strong magnetic force because it's so powerful at that very close range, and it controls these particles. And what would we be able to learn if we could simulate these incredibly small interactions in a computer? And the scientists that are working on this wanted to see what kind of complexities arise out of that if we were able to do that. They also think that a true simulation of physics on this level would, in essence, be equal to simulating the universe itself, which I find pretty mind-blowing. That thought, just thinking about the idea that we would be able to create a simulation that's so accurate that it would be, in essence, a small portion of the universe all by itself. Whoa! So far, because of how complex the physics are.
Assuming they're fundamental, but okay.
And at the size that they're talking about, they've only been able to simulate reality in a computer on a scale of a few femtometers across. And a femtometer is 10 to the negative 15 meters. They claim that at this scale, the simulation is indistinguishable from the real thing, which is awesome. And of course, this being limited to reality as far as we can understand it, right? So like, as far as the human mind can perceive these things, they think that it's that accurate and that close to reality.
Yeah, that's what they said about Avatar, and I wasn't really convinced.
Did they use the term femtometer?
I think they might have, actually.
No. You know what I hate? I saw like somebody ragging on that movie, and they showed like the 10 movies that Avatar ripped off.
Oh, jeez.
It totally ruins the movie because they're like Pocahontas and, you know, Last of the Mohicans. Like, no! All right, so now, guys, imagine as computer processing power increases, as Moore's law states, we will most definitely be able to simulate something the size of a human cell someday. And according to the physicists, this simulated human cell and everything it does will be indistinguishable from the real thing. Hopefully. This thinking has led the scientists to consider the idea that all of reality could be a simulation on an incredibly powerful computer, right? We've talked about this many times before.
Yeah.
This is the first time that the idea makes sense to me, because the simulation starts on the scale of subatomic particles. And now the question arises, can we know if we're in a simulation? And now this is where the real meat starts to come in. So
before we get to that, Jay.
Yeah, meaty.
Yeah.
Philosopher David Kyle Johnson discusses on Irrationally Speaking, you know, Massimo's podcast, and wrote some articles on their blog, which I thought was interesting and tied into this. The probability that we are currently living in a simulation,
yeah,
from a philosophical point of view, what do you think?
It's going to be either
bullshit number
zero
that doesn't
or
have any relation to real life.
50%? No, it's overwhelmingly likely.
A near certainty.
Yeah.
Near certainty.
I'll tell you right now that I don't believe it, Steve. It's because I'm nowhere near as muscular as I would have been, and I would have an incredible singing voice. There's no way that someone would make a simulation and like gimp me the way I've been gimped.
So, well, doesn't mean someone made it, right? It just means the universe is a simulation. It's just its nature, I would think. Does it have to even be created?
So here's the logic. How many universes can we inhabit that are real? The answer is one. How many universes we inhabit that are simulation? That are a simulation?
Quintillions.
Billions. Yeah, so it's billions to one at this. So the only variable is, can we one day simulate a universe? If we can do it, and therefore it's possible, then chances are overwhelming that this universe is one of the billions of simulated universes rather than the one real universe.
Well, as long as I keep the program going, I got no problem with that.
There's something wrong with that line of argument that I can't just put my finger on.
Yeah, it's always seemed to me like one of those trick questions about, you end up with one extra dollar. Where did the dollar come from?
I love that one.
1 billion extra universes here. What's
right,
the
where
problem?
Did they come
Steve,
from?
Steve, the problem is the idea that somebody can turn a switch, end the simulation, and end all of existence. Yeah. That's annoying as hell. But otherwise, I mean, it would be cool and we'd talk about it for like a long time. But what would we really be doing differently if we found that out?
We would
out?
Try to
I
mean, hack not, the program.
Not a damn thing. Why?
That's right, Bob. Hackers unite, baby. We would.
All right, here's another question.
That
here's
would be
a
cool.
philosophical question. What's the difference between a simulated universe and a quote unquote real universe, if that simulation includes simulating fundamental particles the way down?
When you're the ant farm, there's no difference. You don't know the difference.
All right, so walks like a duck, quacks like a duck. That's
right. Yeah, but that's because your question included the most interesting part, which is you said if it includes, you know, all the way down to the particles, you know, all the laws. But
that's because, what Jay said.
But what I'm telling you, the interesting thing though to me about the idea of living in a simulated universe is figuring out the motivations of whatever started the simulation.
That and getting the cheat codes.
You're coming. Oh, yeah. Okay. You're walking towards
the Easter eggs.
You're walking towards the God question, Rebecca. Come on.
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, that's exactly what it is. But in this case, you know, if we knew for a fact that the universe was simulated, then we know that the simulation started somehow.
Well, yeah, sure. Yeah. So, what if
it would raise all kinds of interesting possibilities, you know, because you could certainly program an afterlife into the simulation.
Yeah, so I was thinking about that. Yeah, but how about this? You, at some point, you're running a simulation, and you could have, if say, this being that has a simulation, and then your simulation can also run a simulation, which is what we would be doing if we were a simulation and running the simulation. So what if one of these simulations created, say reached a singularity moment, a stage of singularity in their evolution, and the power consumption went so high that it just fried the computer, and you can't, and the simulation ends when you reach a singularity. I mean, how ironic would that be?
Yeah, it's like that sim game where when people achieve atomic power or atomic weapons, it's over. That's it. The game ends. You nuke someone.
So, Bob, if there are billions of simulations and you can make a simulation within a simulation, then couldn't there be billions of nestled simulations?
Well, yeah, I think that's what the story was we talked about last time. That was the idea.
Right.
And that, because assumption was that when you, once you make a simulation that exactly mimics your own universe, then at some point someone's going to make a simulation of that universe, and yeah, you'll have these nested Inception-like universes. And that's why that philosopher was arguing that we definitely live in a simulation, because that means that there would be an infinite number of simulations, and so, and only one real universe, and so we would be living in one of the simulations.
All right, I'd like to say something.
All right, Jay, how would we
Jay,
know?
How do we know, Jay?
Wait. If we're in a simulation, in a simulation, and I don't know, hopefully the person or the thing that made the simulation is listening right now, which I doubt
wink,
they are.
Wink, wink, nod,
could
nod.
Could you please, like, let me sleep better and help me lose, like, 10 pounds, please?
You are literally praying to God now.
Yeah. Well,
I know. That's what
this, but, oh, my God.
This is the first time where, like, it seems like there might even be a possibility that somebody's listening at least, right?
No. Because even if they make the simulation, they're not going to be – there's a billion, you know, there's 6 billion of us.
Or I think they've clearly lost control of it. Maybe they have tried to turn it off and they've failed because this universe has trumped that, effectively found a way to keep on going despite the efforts of whatever is trying to either shut it down or change it or manipulate it.
Okay, so Silas Bean and his team of researchers at the University of Bonn in Germany.
Sorry, is he from a Harper Lee novel?
They think that they can maybe, in a few scenarios, find evidence that we're in a simulation or not. Okay?
All right.
If we were in a simulation, the computer simulating us would be working in discrete steps, just like any computer would. And what this means is it wouldn't be seamless, kind of like pixels in a picture if you zoom far enough in. These discrete steps could also be thought of like a sample rate in music, right? So when you sample music, you're listening, it's recording a section of it, then it records another section of it. It's not seamless.
Isn't that the Planck length?
Yeah, I think, you know, I was thinking about that as I was going through this. I remembered us talking about it and I read a little bit about it. I couldn't find a parallel or a connection, but in essence, what Steve's saying is that at its absolute fundamental level, there is something that is the smallest that something can get, right?
Yeah, the Planck length. That's the pixel of the universe.
Yeah, it's the Planck length. Essentially, the idea is that length has no meaning smaller than Planck length.
Right.
Like a pixel on a screen. You can't talk about a half a pixel. It's meaningless.
And undefinable.
And there's also an equivalent in terms of time as well, which is called a cronin.
That a simulation would have to be built on a step above the smallest level that it could be, right?
Why?
This is the research. I'm just telling you what they're talking about. So they surmise that if you drill down far enough, that they might be able to detect if the laws of physics are being limited by these discrete steps that they consider to be like a three-dimensional grid or a lattice that advances in steps of time, say, right? So if you just visualize like a three-dimensional lattice, and the structure of reality is built into that framework. Right. So this is all what they're thinking about and how they're going to figure out that there might be a problem. This means that the simulation has a structure to it that at its most basic level might be detectable. Does the grid or lattice, if it's there, limit or skew the way high energy processes in physics should happen? So imagine that the lattice is a simulation and it's not actually small enough to truly mimic the infinitesimals of some atomic particles, and detectable flaws are revealed when it imposes any limitations that it would inherently have because it's a 3D model, right? And there are some important caveats to the study. One problem is that the computer lattice may be constructed in an entirely different way that Bean and his team imagined and would render it indetectable by the way they're looking. Another is if the size is really small, if it's too small, it's going to be undetectable as well because, of the way that they were describing how they would be able to pick up like in these high energy exchanges and how they're being limited by the lattice. There could be a scenario where if it gets too small, they can't pick it up because they can't think of any way to see it when it's that small. The good news is though that this is not a waste of time for a number of reasons. One, first of all, yes, it would be interesting, and horrifying if we found out that we're in a simulation. But two, they are building these computer models and they are simulating very, very small pieces of a virtual reality. And they are increasing this in size as they go on. And, you know, the physics behind these things are so incredibly complicated. That's why it can only be done in such a very small amount of space. But as computer power increases, we're going to be able to increase the size of it, and we'll be able to learn a lot about physics by simulating it.
I see two massive conceptual flaws with that line of reasoning. Mm-hmm. One is, why would the discreteness of the simulation be different than the discreteness of this universe?
I don't know.
Wouldn't it just be the Planck length and the Cronin?
I don't know.
That's
dude.
Why.
Yeah, but then, would it be a simulation? Wouldn't that just be the universe then?
Well, yeah, that's kind of what I was saying before.
Steve,
but
I don't know.
Why would you simulate a universe that has more resolution than you're able to simulate?
Because in order to build the simulation, Steve, it can't be at the most fundamental level. It has to. How could it?
Listen to what I'm saying. If our universe is a simulation, it's embedded in a bigger universe that has a finer grain, but the resolution that we see in our simulated universe is the resolution of the simulated universe.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Right.
Right? Why would that be different? The other massive flaw is, if this universe is simulated, don't you think the programming would be sophisticated enough to adjust any kind of experiments that any simulated beings do in the simulated universe to give the correct answer and not reveal the simulated nature of the universe?
I don't think you could assume the knowledge or motivations of the programmer. Maybe they want people or beings to find it out at some point in their development. That would be a cool little
test.
That's the Easter egg right there. It's like, see, if you can find this out.
So it's not that we have to love him or her unconditionally.
Nope.
Or else we go to hell.
We have to discover the simulated nature of our universe. Yeah. Maybe that's the bet they have going.
Yeah.
How long will it take them
right.
to figure out that they're living in a simulation?
Guys, imagine
that's the end game.
Imagine if it's in the distant future or whatever, a few hundred years from now, and you're able to do a simulation in your computer, and the creatures that you've created in your computer start to worship you.
But yeah, there was a whole Futurama episode about that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there was, wasn't there?
I could deal with that.
Bender became God.
That's right.
God!
And then they launched atomic weapons. Mm-hmm. Destroyed themselves. Very
the
sad.
Game, ended.
Game over.
By the way, your simulation worshiping you is also the plot of Tron.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah.
Yep, that's true.
Well, we'll never sort this one out.
not with that attitude.
And if we do, the creators will never let you know it, so...
Well, that's why.
We may have already figured this out, Steve.
Bob.
Yo.
How's the super jump going, the supersonic jump going? What happened?
It's going very, very well, thank you. I think we can now add supersonic, supersonic skydiving to the Guinness Book of World Records. This is really an amazing feat. Fearless Felix Baumgartner on Sunday, October 14th, became the first person to break the speed of sound in free fall without any airplane or anything around him, just pretty much him in a spacesuit.
He had his suit, yeah.
Yeah. So he reached the amazing and preliminary estimate of 833 miles per hour, or 1,342 kilometers per hour, or Mach 1.24. So he was clearly supersonic. This effort was called the Red Bull Stratus Mission, and they've been working towards this goal since 2003. I didn't know they've been working on it for quite that long.
Wow.
But it just goes to show what an effort this was. He leaped from his capsule attached to a balloon at 128,000 feet approximately, or about 24 miles, 39 kilometers. That's four times the height of most passenger jets. That's really, really up there.
And they're calling that the edge of space, Bob. Is that
yeah, I know.
A misnomer.
I'm getting there, dude. I'm getting
okay.
there, dude.
All right.
He also broke other records. Highest departure from a platform, highest manned balloon flight, which is kind of related, highest free fall without a drogue parachute to slow down, which is somewhat dangerous. I had, when I jumped from 10,000 feet, which is almost as cool as what he did, every parachute's pretty much got a drogue chute, which kind of slows you down and orients you right so that then it pulls the main chute out. He didn't even have one of those. He was in the air. He was flying. He was sailing down for 20 minutes, not in free fall, but the whole duration was 20 minutes, and it only took him about 40 seconds to reach that top speed. That was some pretty wicked acceleration. He said, he's quoted as saying, it's like swimming without touching the water. And it's hard because every time it turns you around, you have to figure out what to do. So I was sticking my arm out, and then it became worse. He said, I had a lot of pressure in my head, but I didn't feel like I was passing out. I was still feeling okay. I thought I can handle this situation, and I did, and he obviously did. I was also wondering about, do you guys wonder about the sonic boom?
Yeah.
I did,
Regarding that, he said he didn't even feel a sonic boom because he was so busy trying to stabilize himself.
Yeah,
and,
that's
and,
right.
And in fact, yeah, he was very busy because for like 35 seconds, he was apparently spinning out of control.
Yeah.
They call it the death spin. And this really could have been, this I think was one of their biggest fears because he could have been spinning so fast that it would just forget it. He could have been injured or died, just from that. And what's weird though is that if you watch him jump, he looks to, when he, the first 10 seconds that I saw of him going down, he looked perfectly oriented and, mm-hmm. and he didn't look like he was spinning. I guess he must have started spinning soon after that.
Yeah, the shot from his helmet cam, you can see it. You're exactly right.
Yeah, I didn't.
Starts off kind of easy and then there goes the spinning. And spinning
wasn't it amazing?
Spinning.
Like he literally disappeared into the, he got so small, like from the ship that brought him up. You know, you're looking
so fast,
at the, he drops and he just turns into a pixel and then he's gone.
Yeah. He said the spin was a lot harder than he thought it was going to be. I thought that was a weird quote because, I mean, he jumped at 95,000 feet. You'd think the spinning would be, nasty at 95,000 as whatever, 128. But I guess it was a lot harder. I do like though how he said that he didn't do this just for the record. He did it for science. doctors claim that from the data from the skydive will break new ground. And, of course, NASA's going to be all over a lot of this too for new spacesuit designs. And that's also going to benefit a lot as well. Even the balloon was really cool. This thing was like 550 feet tall, right? 55 stories. And it had a capacity of 30 million cubic feet. But it was only about 40% the thickness of a Ziploc bag. And what was a little weird though, 40%, that's pretty thin. But they compared that to 3 red blood cells placed edge to edge. Does that sound? I mean, yeah, that doesn't.
Ziploc bags are tiny.
Yeah, they're.
That's what I got from that.
Right? Okay. What I got from that is I think maybe it's a little bit more than 3, but so it's very fragile as you could imagine. Actually, they tried to launch this thing, or not launch it, but they tried to launch the balloon last week or the week before he successfully did it. And, there was a wind gust apparently that caused the balloon to hit the ground and it destroyed it. It just totally destroyed it. Luckily, they had a backup. Otherwise, they would have been in deep crap. One thing, though, Evan, that I noticed, almost every article I read claimed that he jumped from the edge of space. Now, I know the edge of space is subjective, but I think they're taking a little bit too much dramatic license, and I feel like being a little bit pedantic, but that's okay. There's no real edge, of course. The atmosphere gets slowly thinner and thinner as you go up in altitude. But there is some basis to declare, yes, space pretty much starts right here. Now, for comparison, he jumped at 39 kilometers. The United States Air Force will give you anybody an astronaut wings. Well, not anybody, but they will give you astronaut wings if you fly above 80.5 kilometers. Why did they pick that? I don't know why they picked that, but according to the USAF, that's good enough to make you an astronaut. But even more official than that is what I didn't know about this. It's called the Kármán line. You guys ever hear about the Kármán line?
I've not heard that.
What is
That's 62 miles up or 100 kilometers above sea level. That's a suspiciously round number, but Theodore von Kármán is a mathematician, physicist, and aerospace engineer. He came up with this demarcation for a very cool reason. He says that at this distance above sea level, apparently aircraft cannot maintain their altitude through conventional lift, and they have to essentially be in orbit, just as a satellite would. And I think that's just a really great idea. That's a good arbitrary place to make, when space starts. And it's the official boundary of space by the IAF, the International Aeronautic Federation, which governs all international laws on aeronautics and space exploration. So, yeah, that's fairly authoritative right there. But if you really want to be anal about it, I think you need to go to the uppermost section of the top layer of our atmosphere. That's the exosphere. It extends all the way to 10,000 kilometers or 6,200 miles above sea level. In fact, from what I can gather, most scientists consider this to be the really, really official boundary between the atmosphere of Earth and true interplanetary space. So all I got to say to Felix is you have a long way to go, baby. Before you're really at the edge of space. But at
that altitude where he was, the atmospheric pressure was only 2% of sea level.
Yeah. The vast majority of the atmosphere was well below him. So yeah, there's lots of different ways to look at it.
You need to be in a spacesuit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know. Yeah, you could definitely make the claim, but I like the Kármán line. I think that's pretty good. I mean,
you could still say it was the edge of space. It's just a very long edge.
Yeah, very thick edge.
One of the edges of space.
You know what I found most interesting was not the records he set, but the record he didn't set, which was longest free fall. Yeah. Considering that, you know, nobody has ever jumped from a higher place. He didn't free fall the longest. He must have been trucking.
Yeah. And he pulled a chute. I read at 8,000 feet, which is, you know, that's a nice, relatively low altitude, especially compared to where he was. So that was kind of surprised and disappointed. Like, really? He didn't have the longest free fall? But yeah, I guess it's gotta be related to just how fast he was flying through the atmosphere.
Well, congratulations. That is cool. It takes guts to do something like that.
And he's retired now. No more jumping for Felix.
Hope so.
Oh yeah. Good way to end it.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to improve that. Now, that'll probably stand for a while, I would say. Maybe not the 50 years at the first, you know, the record that he broke, but
yeah.
It could be a while.
Evan, do you think he could see some geoglyphs from up there?
No doubt he could see geoglyphs from up there.
You've been practicing your segue, Steve.
Oh, those geoglyphs, you know.
And yeah, he still can't do a segue so smooth that we won't all point it out to him.
Yeah, right.
We've been at this too long, right? A huge geoglyph in the shape of an elk or a deer has been discovered in Russia, in the Ural Mountains north of Kazakhstan. Archaeologists are saying it may predate Peru's famous Nazca lines by thousands of years.
Oh, wow.
A geoglyph is a large design produced on the ground, typically shaped using rocks or stone fragments, and the designs are relatively simple in the sense that they're just the outlines of either animals or humans kind of doing something. They're not all that extravagant, but they are very, very impressive. Now, this elk, or deer, whichever you prefer, stretches for about 900 feet at its farthest points, northwest to southeast. And that's about two American football fields, for those of you outside America. The figure faces north and would have been visible from a nearby ridge, which is interesting because, you know, you didn't necessarily, I guess, have some kind of bird's eye view to see exactly what was going on. Visible from a nearby ridge. I found that interesting. Now, this particular geoglyph was discovered when someone found it using Google Earth, an old image dating back to 2007. Alexander Shestakov was the one who first discovered this, and he alerted researchers who went out on a mission. They sent a hydroplane and a paraglider to survey the structure, and sure enough, there it was. These findings were detailed in the journal called Antiquity, and they were written by Stanislav Grigoryev of the Russian Academy of Sciences and Institute of History and Archaeology, and Nikolai Menshinin of the State Center for Monument Protection. The field work that these researchers performed at the site this past summer suggested that the geoglyph might be the product of a megalithic culture. Now, European megalithic culture was a prehistoric culture that stretched from the Iberian Peninsula in the south and Sweden and the Orkney Islands to the north and stretched from the Baltics all the way to the Atlantic. So it was a pretty wide civilization at the time, or culture, I should say. And among the finds from the excavations that they found were also these stone tools, about 40 of them, and they were made of quartzite, and they were found on the structure's surface. They were pickaxe tools called mattocks, which are useful for digging and chopping or perhaps extracting clay. And this style of stonework was called lithic chipping that was used on those artifacts. It dates back to the Neolithic and Eneolithic times, which is 6th to 3rd millennia BC, roughly, right? So 6,000 BC.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive. Whereas the Nazca lines, we're talking estimates of about 500 to 600 BC. So what we have here are the famed Nazca lines, which we've talked about before on the show and are familiar in skeptical circles. These are the ones in Peru, on the beaches of Peru, in which were discovered many, many years ago. And it was a lot of controversy and discussion as to how they could have possibly made, like an ancient culture, basically made these possible things without the benefit of having either something to go up in the air, flight, or, you know, help from another civilization more technologically advanced than ours. But these date even thousands of years prior to that. And there are other examples around the world that have been also recently discovered, say in the Middle East, which are also showing these kinds of geoglyphs. Okay, so what's skeptical about these, and why? What does any of this have to do with skepticism? It was believed by some, such as Eric von Däniken, that their size and purpose speculate that visitors from other planets must have created or directed the project. It's also suggested that perhaps, by some, that they had some sort of, the Nazcas and these other cultures, had some sort of manned flight vehicles, balloons or whatnot, that were used, you know, so they could get up above the ground and actually kind of see and direct what was going on. But that's another theory, pretty wild theory, that was is kind of got pushed off to the side, and science has realized, nope, that's not how they did it. It's been done before. Just Joe Nickel, in fact, has written papers.
Joe!
And a book, I believe, about the Nazcas and how they could have done it using just the technology of the age, without flight, without the assistance of aliens or any other such thing, and just using the tools of the time. It is proven that it can be done.
Now, this particular geoglyph is not that impressive looking. I mean, you've got to really squint hard to see the elk.
I'd like to see you make a geoglyph.
Thousands of years ago.
I didn't think you'd take me up on that.
I'll make a geoglyph.
I see what you're saying. You're right. It's got this sort of anteater nose to it. Is that what
I'm looking really at? Yeah, really elongated muzzle.
But aliens need not apply. Humans have been doing this for thousands of years. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
Thank you, Steve. I'm going to play for you last week's Who's That Noisy? So here we go.
We just give a large dose of green black walnut hull.
And what does that do?
That kills the stages, larval stages of the Phaseolopsis parasite called the intestinal fluke.
Intestinal fluke.
Yes, and parasites. Yeah, so who talks about parasites and analyzing diseases and thinking that all human diseases is related to parasites? Who do we know that used to say that?
Name that quacky.
Could it be Hulda? Hulda Clark, perhaps?
Hulda Clark, yep.
Perhaps?
Yep.
I know I said this story, but I have to repeat it. I got an email from a Hulda Clark devotee who was criticizing the medical profession for making claims beyond the evidence and overselling their knowledge and capability. Wow. And I had to point out to him that Hulda Clark's first book was called The Cure for All Cancer. And her next book was The Cure for All Disease. Oh, I'm sorry, who's overselling their knowledge and ability? Who?
I don't know if there's a bigger red flag in alternative medicine than blaming everything on one source. All disease, all cancer, all anything. That's about as big a red flag as you can wave.
You also have to point that out now. The asterisk next to her name forever is the woman who claimed to have the cure for all cancer. Died on September 3rd, 2009 of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Multiple myeloma. Well,
you can't fight it off forever, Steve. Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah, her pact with Satan ended years ago. So. Correct answers were provided to us, but the person who guessed correctly first from the message boards, Esther, she says, Dr. Hulda Clark, ? And I answered, why, yes. Dr. Hulda Clark. Well done, Esther.
Good job. And what do you got for this week?
Here we go. Latest and greatest, fresh off the presses. Who's That Noisy? All right.
Another rumbly noise.
Is that Felix?
Good guess, Bob. No, not Felix. Not Felix. I try not to do that. I try not to borrow noisies from the most current of news items that we're covering. So that's a rare occasion, but not a bad guess. And if you have a guess of your own, you'd like to submit it, it's info@theskepticsguide.org, and our forums are sguforums.com, and we would love to hear from you. Good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Evan. We're sitting here at TAM 2012 with Jamie Ian Swiss. Jamie, welcome back to the Skeptic's Guide.
Great to be here. Always a pleasure.
Always.
So let's see. What should we talk about?
How's the weather?
You gave what might be described as a rather provocative and fiery talk at TAM just now. So tell us what you were talking about.
I was talking about the skeptic mission. I was talking about things that skeptics have always discussed, have sometimes argued about what it means to be a skeptic and what we're supposed to be doing. And increasingly in recent years, that discussion has enlarged in some ways and intensified in some ways about the differences between skepticism and secular humanism, and in particular atheism, because of the success of the new atheist, so-called new atheist movement.
So yeah, so it sounds like it's about mission creep. That maybe the mission of scientific skepticism has maybe gotten blurred with other agendas because as our movement grows, because we made the point that growing is a good thing, but that also means that we have to keep re-asking the question: what actually is our mission and our identity, and what are we being activists for?
Right. Why are we here? What do we think? What motivates us? What are our goals? And, when we talk about it is about mission creep. Absolutely. And mission creep is a kind of, it's a policy statement. It's mission creep is something for organizations to worry about rather than individuals in many ways. And not every individual is responsible for being a strategist for the movement. But organizations have to care about that a lot. Many a nonprofit organization has demolished itself or just faded away because of a lack of clarity about mission. You can only do so much. And we're talking about movements that to a great degree overlap. There's a lot of overlapping belief, overlapping thinking. Secular humanists and especially many atheists, science-based atheists, if you will, identify as skeptics. And skeptics welcome them, and the new atheist movement and its success has brought a lot of attention to the skeptic movement in many ways, and vice versa. And I think in some ways we've become a victim of those successes because it blurred the lines for a while. But I think those lines need to be clarified, and as I said on the stage, not as battle lines about what we're supposed to be fighting about, but rather as divisions of labor between armies that are aligned on different battlefields in the same war. Mm-hmm. Whether it's, you have the Army and the Marines and the Air Force and the Navy, we're all supposed to be on the same side, and we're not supposed to be battling each other.
Are we having internal discussions and battles, not because of what the skeptical movement should be about, but more about what concerns other groups more? Like, it's not really about people saying we're defining what skepticism is. It just so happens that they're bringing up topics that they find to be more important or what their hot topics are.
I think where the tension has arisen is the skeptic movement's been around for a while. PsyCop was founded 36 years ago, I think. And we've been discussing and trying to figure out what the mission is ever since. But I think that with the explosion of atheist activists who are, on the one hand, who quickly self-identify as skeptics, but on the other hand, are new to the skeptic movement, I think the tensions have arisen because many of those people say, no, this is what skepticism should be, and skepticism should be a lot about atheism because I'm an atheist and I'm a skeptic.
Right.
And I think that's where the tensions really arise from, is people trying to shift the focus and meaning and framing of the skeptic mm-hmm. movement. And what I'm trying to say is that the skeptic movement needs to hold on to its core values and its core subjects. And it's not just atheists that we're under fire from. There's also this so-called skepticism 2.0, that says that, okay, enough about Bigfoot and enough about the paranormal and enough about alien abductions or whatever the thing is. Let's talk about stuff that's actually important or that really matters. And I don't buy that at all. That's another onslaught on skepticism on another front that I think just as Daniel Oxen says, just because we're tired of talking about it doesn't mean those issues don't matter.
Right.
Those are core. The paranormal and extraordinary claims, the debunking of extraordinary claims, the explanation of thinking, how to think about extraordinary claims, that's the skeptic's core strengths and values and expertise in things that no one else deals with in exactly the same way.
Right. So in other words, it's the base service that we provide to society.
Yeah. Daniel Loxton has said that scientists don't have the expertise on nonsense, mm-hmm. on the nonsense yeah. side, right?
Yeah, we see that over and over again. Now, we got involved in the skeptical movement in 1996, and at that moment, this very fight was raging. And this was mainly through PSYCOP, which was the only real national mm-hmm. organization at that time, and we went to the meetings there, and we got embroiled in this discussion about, you know, the lines between secular humanism and skepticism. And I remember getting personally involved in a lot of discussions yep. with atheists who were really very passionate about the fact that skepticism is atheism. It's not this other thing. And stop worrying about UFOs and Bigfoot. God is the only thing we need to debunk. Which, you know, our approach has always been, that's fine, you go do that.
Exactly.
But don't tell me what to do.
Exactly.
We can define our own mission, thank you. I think that actually really hurt PSYCOP for a while because they kind of got embroiled in that and kind of stalled their they were trying to outreach to local groups, and all the local groups were like, we don't want to be under the yoke of secular humanism.
I completely agree. PSYCOP began as PSYCOP, Committee for the Scientific Investigation and Claims of the Paranormal. Later, over time, as Paul Kurtz expanded his interests, he's a philosopher, and so now he creates Center for Inquiry and Free Inquiry Magazine and so forth. And I think that at a time when PSYCOP was, you know, the only game in town, as you say, and their influence and the fact that most local groups had started up with PSYCOP's support on the one hand, but attempts to control on the other, and now that PSYCOP was side by side with secular humanism, and now talk about mission creep, those missions really became conflated.
Yeah.
No matter how much they tried to pretend right. they were separate, it's the same organization.
Yeah.
And I agree completely. And when that started to happen, I mean, I was involved with National Capital Area Skeptics, and we objected strongly to that. We're not an atheist organization.
Right.
We won't be an atheist organization. And as you say, if you identify as a skeptic, you're sympathetic to and supportive of skeptic cause, but you think atheism is an important place to be active, that's great. That's fine. You're completely welcome in my skeptic tent. Completely mm-hmm. welcome. But again, as according for myself in the talk, you know, what you're not welcome to do is come and move my tent.
Right.
Don't tell me what to do. You do what you want, but don't tell me what to do.
I've always likened it as a tug of war, right? You know, skepticism's the rope, and it's being tugged in all these different directions and trying to be claimed, or if you pardon the term, hijacked by certain other groups, depending on how extreme you want to get. And they want to try to capture it and make it their own. And I think we also see this with certain pseudosciences, like the anti-vax movement. They're trying to claim the term skeptics for themselves.
Global warming
folks. It's everyone's pulling at these threads, and they want to make it theirs. But leave skepticism alone, because it's not anyone individuals. Let's leave the definition as it is.
Right, but there's two different sets of forces there, I would say, which is, you know, as far as atheism, we're still all on the side of scientific skepticism, and there's where that term scientific skepticism, which I think Sagan coined, is valuable, because when you start talking about anti-vaxxers or these, you know, I've never met a believer who in any kind of woo who didn't immediately start the conversation by calling themselves a skeptic. But they're not a skeptic in the term we mean, mm-hmm. and they're mm-hmm. certainly not scientific skeptics. They just mean, oh, well, I didn't believe it until I did. But the way I did has nothing to do with what we call scientific skepticism.
All right, so an important question. How is the realization from Jamie's speech today, which is maybe it's not new to any of us, but you know, to the overall community, now that we've opened this discussion, how are we going to turn this into a positive thing? You know, I think a few things that need to be said are, and Jamie said many times, we're not saying that these other organizations don't have value and they don't have fantastic mission statements, or at least the work that they're trying to do is moving in the right direction. It's pushing the ball forward. But we're saying, as the hardcore skeptical community, this is our mission statement.
You know, I'm trying to clarify the thinking. I'm trying to help people think about what it is they want to do with their activism and their energy and their passion. If you want to start a skeptics group or become involved in a local skeptics group, great. If you want to start an atheist group or become active in the local atheist group, fine. But think clearly about which it is you want to do and why. And at the same token, you know, when you lend your support to a national skeptics group, if you lend your support to the James Randi Educational Foundation, let's be clear about what you're lending your support to and why.
Okay.
And don't come in and immediately start telling us we're doing it wrong because we're not active enough of your particular pet issue. The JREF has always been explicitly clear. It's in the mission statement. It's always been explicitly clear that we are concerned with scientific education, critical thinking, rational inquiry, extraordinary claims, paranormal claims, pseudoscience. This is the skeptic mission. It's always been clear about that. And, you know, enough already with people coming in and saying, we're going to change the JREF mission. No, you're not going to change the JREF mission. You're going to come and join our mission, or you're going to come and do something else. And if you go and do something else, and if you need to walk away because you need to do something else, that's fine. I'm totally willing to live with that. You know, again, just stop. You know, don't come in and tell me you're going to move the tent.
Right.
I know exactly where the tent is. Thank you very much.
So I guess one of the ways in which that could get the lines there can get a little bit blurry is this. But, you know, to go back a little bit, Jay, this conversation has been happening. You know, this is not like
I know
as
that,
much
but,
as Jamie's talk was a great kick in the ass.
Absolutely.
You know, he's quoting from
Steve. I've been talking to Jamie about it for 2 years.
Oh, I know.
I'm introducing
just to clarify
this
for our listeners.
Yeah, for our audience.
This is not like, oh, we're just suddenly addressing this issue. I mean, he's quoting things that people have written over the last 10 years because we've been talking about
longer
this issue. I mean, yeah, as long as I've been in the skeptical movement, we've been having this conversation.
From the day, I have to say, you know, even PsyCop, not so much on the atheist issue at the time, that came up more with the CFI and free inquiry. But when we started National Capital Area Skeptics, you know, PsyCop was playing this game where, you know, they were not a membership organization because they wanted absolute control over their message, so they didn't want members.
Right.
And they, you know, were very explicit about, you know, we're going to help you and we're going to guide you, and but you're not a chapter. You're not a chapter of us. You're independent. You're independent, but we're going to tell you everything to do and think.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we at National Capital Area Skeptics, Chip Demon and I, among others, you know, we were like, actually, you know, that independent thing that you're talking about, we're all for that. And as a matter of fact, we're going to do exactly that.
That's what everyone did.
And,
yeah.
And you know, even though we hosted, and listen, Phil Klass helped us start, you know, and Phil and I, we had these arguments, you know, a lot. And it was very useful in some ways because as we created the bylaws, you know, Phil was extremely paranoid about, about being invaded by outsiders and being infiltrated. And, and some of that was correct. I took that.
Yeah.
Some people were completely against that. And I thought that was valid. It's one of the reasons we created a very large board of directors so one person couldn't get in and hijack. But the fact of the matter is, even though we hosted a PsyCop conference, National PsyCop conference, 2 years after we started, we took that independence very, very seriously.
Yeah.
And they were aggravated about it. You know, they were annoyed about it. And they also tended to look at the skeptic activism as a kind of a zero-sum game. You know, when Mike Shermer came on the scene, they were not happy campers.
Yeah.
As if there was only so many skeptics out there in the world, you know, to support. And indeed, even though PsyCop, you know, gave us a mailing list, a regional skeptic inquiry mailing list when we started National Capital Area Skeptics, I was astonished, I don't know if I've ever said this publicly, but screw it, when, you know, 20 years later, I started New York City Skeptics, and they went, no, we're not going to, I went to PsyCop, is it going to help me out? No, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. Like 20 years later, you haven't learned anything?
Nope.
Yeah.
You haven't, what?
Old school.
Right?
So here's I think a fuzzy area that maybe we can get to, and this is very relevant recently. So if you have some other mission, go and do that. That's great, but don't tell us to change this scientific skeptic mission. But there are people out there, individuals who have put two missions together. Not to say that skepticism is this other thing, but they're going to simultaneously. Like, you know, for example, there are some popular bloggers who say this blog is atheist, skeptical, and liberal. I mean, they are with no bones about, I'm going to promote a political liberal agenda at the same time that I promote atheism and skepticism. So that kind of thing, and of course there's, you know, the Skeptic, which promotes feminism and skepticism. So that's another example of that that's, you know, obviously been very active recently. So how do you feel about that? They're not saying that skepticism needs to be liberal or needs to be feminist, but we are choosing to do both of these things.
Right. As long as I'm not saying that skepticism has to be defined by their particular interest, I'm totally fine with that. That's fine. You're welcome in a tent. These are individuals.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I'm not trying to say that, you know, we as some national organization are going to tell you, we're going to crack the whip and we're going to get you all in line and we're going to tell you what to think and how to do it and what to do. But this is why I am telling you, this is why we are doing it this way.
Yeah.
This is why New York City Skeptics and the National Capital Area Skeptics and the JREF thinks that skepticism is this. This is what we think skepticism is, and this is why we're doing it this way.
Right.
And then it's, you know, then it's up to you. And I think for individuals, fine, tie all that together. Listen, you can make links between, you can draw linkages between atheism and skepticism, not very hard. You can certainly, you can also draw links between probably certain left of center political leanings and secular humanism. I mean, certainly philosophically, people can make those connections.
And Penn and Teller make it between libertarianism and skepticism.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So the world is full of extraordinary claims. So, that, you know, that's all fine. I'm not looking to police anybody, but it's, as you said, the important caveat, Steve, is that then they don't walk in and say, what I'm interested in, because I'm interested in all these things, that's what the skeptical agenda should be. And another point that I make is that skeptics should be focused on, are focused on, have always been focused on how to think, not what to think. Atheism is one thing to think that might well have been, you might reach that conclusion through skeptical tools, rational inquiry tools. But I'm interested in teaching people a way of thinking, and that's really the guiding point. And if we stick to that, if we hew to that, then it really keeps the tent wide open in terms of diversity of cultural value issues, mm-hmm. whether it's feminism or liberalism or libertarianism, or, you know, we can go down, you know, we can go down the line on all of that, vegetarianism, we can go down the line. The skeptic tent should be open to all of those things.
All right, well, Jamie, thank you so much for sitting down
with us.
Thank
you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Sorry we had nothing
to
talk about.
Yeah, right.
I know. This was those awkward silences, you know. If you had to listen to the real thing without all the editing, you know, it would just be like this long area of hum. It would be like a Neil Young album with just feedback.
Thanks, all right,
Jamie.
Take care, Jamie.
Thanks, Jamie. Thanks for having me.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. The theme is the Nobel Prize.
No.
Yes.
How Nobel.
So good with this.
Three items about the Nobel Prize. I think I just heard Jay volunteer to go first.
I'm psyched. Let's do it.
All right. Item number one. The 1926 Nobel Prize in Medicine was awarded to Johann Fibiger for his discovery of, quote, a cure for cancer. Item number two, the New York Times announced that the 1915 Nobel Prize in Physics was to be shared by Nikola Tesla and Thomas Edison, but they never received the award, it is rumored, because neither man would consent to share the award with the other. Item number three, the 1949 Nobel Prize in Medicine was shared by Antonio Caetano de Abreu Ferrer y Gamoniz.
Fiction.
For the development of the frontal lobotomy.
Because of that name.
Jay, go first.
I'm going to start with the last one first. And that was the one about the guy that got the Nobel Prize for the development of the frontal lobotomy. And I'm going to absolutely say that that one is true. That is science. The second one about the one that was supposed to be shared by Tesla and Edison, but they didn't receive the award. Something about that one is reminding me of truth. I know the two of them butt heads, and this would be an interesting turn of events. And I do think I remember something about this. So that one's true. So therefore, I don't believe that the first one, the cure for cancer, is the truth. That one is the fiction.
Okay, Rebecca.
Well, Jay sounded so confident, but I'm not sure I agree. So, cure for cancer. Yeah, we were just talking about how they like to wait to give it out to make sure that the thing isn't debunked or whatever. However, it could be a discovery that ended up not being a cure for cancer, but was still amazing in its own right, or it could be something that was just called a cure for cancer in the papers at the time. So I can buy that one. And I can also buy the idea of a Nobel Prize being given to someone for the development of the frontal lobotomy. That was all the rage for a while there. That makes sense. So that leaves us with Nikola Tesla and Thomas Edison, who, yeah, did, you know, obviously Tesla had a lot of resentment, I'm sure, towards Edison. Edison was kind of an asshole to him. However, that one is weird to me because Nobel Prizes, maybe they were different back then, but these days I think that they are a surprise in general. I don't think anybody's quite sure that they're going to get them before they get them. And so why would they refuse to consent to share the award before it's even been given to them? I don't think that that's true. So I'm going to go with that one being the fiction.
Alrighty, Bob.
Yeah, I agree with pretty much everything Rebecca said. She makes a lot of sense. The first one about the cure for cancer, that's a very interesting angle about, yeah, maybe it still was dramatic in some way and initially hailed as a cure for cancer, but not, obviously was not a cure for cancer. Also, I could justify this by saying that they just weren't as sophisticated and slick as they are now and waiting, and maybe this is one of the reasons why they do that. The third one, the frontal lobotomy, yeah, that was, in its time, it was lauded, to an extent that would be surprising to modern day people. It was really seemed like an amazing treatment. You know, so many studies done showing apparently that it really helped these people. And I could see that this guy winning a Nobel for it. The second one, to me, with Tesla and Edison, seems to make, too much sense. It's like, that's obvious. Which I know is not a great reason, to make something fiction, but it kind of stands out for me. Plus the fact that I really think I would have heard of this if these two were awarded and they just didn't want to have a joint acceptance. So for that and for that and other reasons, I'm going to say that one is fiction. Tesla and Edison.
And Evan.
Steve, what's the fallacy that it essentially encompasses, I would have heard of that. Isn't there a fallacy that, right? It's the,
argument ad Bobbium.
Yeah. Congratulations, Bob. You're
not always a fallacy, though.
A fallacy.
Reverse
order. 49 prize in medicine, Moniz, the frontal lobotomy. I know this one to be a science because memory serves. We talked about this and we reviewed it as part of this day in skepticism way back when. And I'm saying that one is science. Now, so it comes down to the other ones. Now, this 1915 one for the Nobel Prize in Physics, Tesla and Edison. Bob, I've not heard of this either. I didn't even know they were up for these awards, to tell you the truth. And you're right. That would have been something that you think they would have taught us in the history books or, you know, even the most basic science classes. But I think it's the other one that's the fiction, the cancer one. Jay, you went with that. 26th Nobel Prize. Cure for cancer. He did something else, if I'm not mistaken. It may have had something to do with a cure for something else, but I don't think it was cancer. I think he worked on a different disease. And for the life of me, I can't remember, but I just don't remember the name cancer and his name going together. So I'm going to say that one's the fiction.
Okay, so we have an even split.
You all agree.
But you all agree that the 1949 Nobel Prize in Medicine was shared by Antonio Moniz for the development of the frontal lobotomy. And that one is science.
That's true.
And yeah, interesting, but that is, I do think we talked about this before. Moniz shared the award with Walter Rudolf Hess. Hess for his discovery of the functional organization of the interbrain as a coordinator of the activities of the internal organs. And Moniz for his discovery of the therapeutic value of leucotomy in certain psychoses.
Leucotomy.
Leucotomy is the more technical term for a frontal lobotomy. And it was considered at the time to be revolutionary. It was partly stemming from his discovery that this part of the brain, you know, that part of the frontal lobes had this effect that it could dramatically, you know, by poking a hole in the brain, you could dramatically alter someone's personality. In this specific case, take them from being psychotic to being very placid, apathetic, one might say. Very interesting. Part of the insurmountable evidence that the brain causes consciousness, in my opinion. So very interesting that, you know, we look back now at frontal lobotomy as something very barbaric, but at the time it was given Nobel Prize for something to be something very, ahead of its time.
Prize worthy.
So let's go to number two. The New York Times announced that the 1915 Nobel Prize in Physics was to be shared by Nikola Tesla and Thomas Edison, but they never received the award. It is rumored because neither man would consent to share the award with the other. Rebecca and Bob think that this one is the fiction. Jay and Evan think that this one is science, and this one is science.
Oh, curses!
Thank you. Yeah, I told you I knew this stuff.
thanks for blazing the trail, Jay.
Interesting story. It took me a long time to try to figure out how to say this one. I was saved by finding that the New York Times announced it. Because I need to be able to say something definitive because I couldn't absolutely verify that this actually happened. But it absolutely did happen that the New York Times announced Edison and Tesla to get Nobel Prize. And then it was given to Bragg and Bragg, a father-son team, one of the family teams, but not Tesla and Edison. And then the rumors started. So again, it was rumored. I couldn't find any, you know, the official Nobel website is silent on this issue. But there are many references, mostly leading back to the same couple of sources, talking about the fact that in 1912, Tesla was apparently up for the Nobel Prize in Physics, and he apparently expressed the notion that he would not accept it if Edison was also given the award. And then in 15, there was this premature announcement by the New York Times that they both got it, and then they didn't get it. And so the rumor mill started, and it was, you know, the conventional wisdom was that the prize was going to be given to them, but then it was withheld and given to the other physicists when they essentially both men would refuse to share the stage with the other, or would refuse to accept the prize if the other were getting it. Their rivalry was so famous by that time that, you know, that rumor instantly took off. But the Nobel organization, the Nobel Committee, as far as I could find, never absolutely confirmed that that's what happened. As you said, Rebecca, it's a secret, you know, who's going to get the award. But after 50 years, nominations are made public, and so we do know now that both Edison and Tesla were nominated in different years for the Nobel Prize, but they never received it, which is interesting.
Which means
that the 1926 Nobel Prize in Medicine was awarded to Johann Fibiger for his, I'm probably butchering that name, but for his discovery of a quote-unquote a cure for cancer is fiction. Although that is a rumor you will see on different websites, which I always like when websites get it wrong. Uh-huh. But when you look at the official quote, what he was given the award for, it was for his discovery of the Spiroptera carcinoma. So he did discover a parasite that caused infections that he said caused cells to become cancerous. So it was thought that he discovered the cause of cancer, not the cure for cancer. And then it turns out that was wrong also. Mm-hmm. All he did was identify one possible irritation that can cause cells to become cancerous, but lots of other things can do the same thing, trauma and infection, etc. So it's the irritation and damage to the cell that then can make it predisposed to becoming cancerous. It's nothing specific about the infectious agent that he discovered. So the conclusions of his discovery were later reversed, although he still gets credit for making significant advances in the study of cancer. He didn't find the cause of cancer. And there was never any issue of him discovering the cure for cancer, but that was how the incident was misreported on various websites that I came across.
Well, congratulations, Evan and Jay.
Yes.
Thank you.
So, yeah, this is a rare J. Evan victory on science fiction.
What the hell is that supposed to mean?
Well, it just means that, yeah. Yeah, what the hell is that supposed to mean, Steve? Yeah.
You two guys winning and Jay and Bob and Rebecca losing is an uncommon event.
Statistically, we've done enough shows where it's bound to happen.
It's bound to happen, absolutely.
Nice job, Jay.
Nice job, Evan.
Mainly because I'm frankly surprised that Evan went with you over Bob and Rebecca.
Yeah, me too.
So good work, Evan. Good work.
Yeah, thanks. I followed my gut and it worked.
Better than following the herd.
In this case.
Jay, do you have a quote for us this
Although
week?
It's a high-quality herd, you could have followed.
It's true.
Yep, this was a quote sent in by many people, so I'm not going to give credit to the people that sent it in. But I will say that this is a quote by someone called Erica Dunning, and the quote is, "You can do magic with science, but you can't do science with magic." Anybody know who Erica is?
Yeah, Erica Dunning. She's that girl.
Yeah.
That's Brian Dunning's daughter.
Yeah.
How old
is
she?
Awesome.
Brian didn't tell me how old she was, but I'm assuming that she's quite young. Brian sent it in, and a lot of other listeners sent that quote in. I guess he said it on his show. I hadn't heard it. It must have been a very recent show. But I thought it was really cute, and it was, you know, I just love the minds of kids and how they just come up with things that seem so obvious but can be so
pithy.
Profound. Right? And pithy, right.
Yes.
Yeah, I like it.
So that's a quote by
Erica Dunning!
Yeah, Erica.
Good job, Erica.
Way to go, Erica.
Well done.
Erica.
Well, thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
Good to be joined with you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Once again.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice. Uh-huh.